Session number 9427.
There's a Charles Withriel too.
And on these marches, we go so far, perhaps 4 or 5 miles, and then we'd break on the roadside and have a rest, and various little activities would take place amongst different groups. Some would produce a ball and have a little game of football, and others would run around, and then there was occasionally we had these boxing matches. There was a real parson by the name of Hilliard. He was a boxer, a good boxer, and he always was prepared to take anyone on. And there was a policeman from South Wales, ex-policeman from South Wales, and I just can't remember his name, or Hibbard, I believe his name was, but I'm not sure. And another one from South Wales named Craddock. They were always in on the boxing. I remember that clearly. And then of course after a rest we'd march back to Madrigaris, and that was it. That was the day's activities over as far as militarism was concerned. And in the evening times we used to go to the club in the village, which was a big upstairs room above some shops with a bar in it. And of course, there was only old men left in the village, really, but some of them would gather and bring the guitars and give us an impromptu concert.
What about weapons training?
Well, there just wasn't any because we didn't have weapons. We did get rifles eventually, but with no ammunition, so... when we did eventually go into action at Harama, I'd never fired a rifle in my life. Never. That was the very first time I put a rifle round into a rifle and fired it.
What was the morale like at Madrigueras?
Oh, I mean, it was jollity. One of jollity, really. We all knew what we'd gone for, and we knew that sooner or later we'd be going into battle. And that was it.
But was everybody keen to fight?
Well, I don't know whether you can say everyone was keen to fight. I don't think I looked on it in that way at all. I mean, I knew when we were at Madrigaris, I knew we'd been formed into a battalion, and I knew we were part of a brigade, and I knew that sooner or later we'd have to go into action. But that was it as far as I was concerned. I mean, I wasn't keen to get on with it, and I wasn't fighting away from it either. That's really all there was to it. I should think most people's out was like that. Although we did after we got to Madrigaris and been there some days, we were joined by what became known as Number One Company. And they were the people who'd gone out before us. And they'd been a company, Number One Company, attached to Spanish battalions, and they'd been at Madrid and Cordova and one or two other places, fighting as an individual unit with Spaniards. But they were brought out of the line and brought back to Madrigaris, and they became part of the battalion.
Which individuals were in this Number One Company?
Well, I can't name them all. Maurice Levine was one, for instance. Glenn Beckett. I don't suppose that name means anything to you, does it? Anyway, he was. Glenn Beckett was the top motorcycle speedway rider of the day, and he was the first man to. Invent, or call it what you will, the Wall of Death. And he toured Europe with it before he went to Spain. He came from Oldham, and he was quite a celebrity in the motorcycling world in those days, like. And even today in Oldham, a lot of people remember him for that. Most of the commanders came from that Number One Company, for instance. Tom Wintringham, he was the battalion commander. Ted Springall, he was the political commissar. Dead Spring Hall went to China eventually, I believe. And there was others, Dickinson and others from that company. They formed the basis of the commanders, you might say, of the battalion.
Did they say anything about what they'd been through?
Well, only in casual conversation. That's all. It wasn't impressed upon us at any time. Like, it was only as individuals someone might tell you about something, but it wasn't given to us as a talk or anything like that.
Did you have any political instruction?
No, none whatsoever. No.
Or any instruction about the importance of what you were doing?
No, with no political instructions at all. And as far as the importance of what we were doing, we all knew that in the first place, or else we wouldn't have gone, you know. In all the 2 years I was in Spain, I don't think there were three political, what you might call political lectures. I don't think there were three. No.
How did the men get on with each other?
Well, as far as I can see, there was never any. You know, it was just a normal, what you might call a normal army life. There was no fighting or anything like that amongst ourselves. It was quite a friendly group of people. I mean, you got to know one or two better than the... Well, you didn't get to know many people at all, really. I got to know one or two who became very good friends of mine, and you more or less stuck with that little group, and you were friends amongst yourself, and that was it. You know, you mingled with the others, other than on a military basis.
Who were your particular friends?
Well, one was a fellow called Jock Henderson. He was the postman. I took his job over eventually. And a funny thing about Jock Henderson, he was sent home. And after Spain, well, after the Second World War ended, I was still living here in Grantham, like. And after I was demobbed, I got a job at Barford's in town. And I was there for 12 months. And it wasn't until after I left Barford's that I found out that this Jock Henderson had been working at Barford's while I was there. I may have seen him, I don't know, but I wouldn't have recollect, you know, I can't recollect seeing him. But he was there while I was there, and then he moved to Melton Mowbray. And he used to speak in the marketplace on Sunday nights. But I only found this out afterwards, otherwise I'd have contacted him, like, but I was never able to contact him afterwards. I tried asking in Melton Mowbray, but no one seemed to know anything about it.
Speak on behalf of whom?
In the marketplace.
On behalf of which organisation?
The Labour Party. Mm. He wasn't speaking on their behalf. It was on his own initiative, but he was speaking for... He was putting forward propaganda for the Labour Party.
Who else was your friend then?
Wally Togwell, Cliff Wolstenholme, Joe Lees. And that's about it, really. Amongst those, I'd call me real friends. You know, there were plenty of others that I was quite friendly with, but they were what I'd call the little group of my friends.
Apart from those people who were your friends, do any particular individuals stand out in your mind at Madrigueras?
Not at Madrigueras, no, because at Madrigueras there was nothing for anything to stand out. There was no reason for anything to stand out because we weren't doing anything particularly, and what we did do, everybody did exactly more or less exactly the same. So there was nothing. There was nothing really for anything to stand out there.
Were you put into a particular company at Madrigueras?
Yeah, I was in Number 4 Company, but it wasn't a particular company. It was one company. There were four companies, and I was in Number 4.
Who was the commanding officer?
A fella called Overton. I think he'd been in the British Army, but I'm not sure. I think he had, but I'm not sure.
Were you put into a specific platoon?
Yes, but I can't remember that. Or with the platoon commander, I can remember, was a Scotchman, but I can't remember his name.
Who was in the same platoon as you?
I can't even remember anyone from that platoon, the names. None of my personal friends were in that platoon at all, or even in the same company. Certainly, because most of these personal friends hadn't materialised, as far as I was concerned, at that time when the battalion was formed while we were at Madvigaris. The stronger friendships were formed actually either during or immediately after a battle. That's when the strongest friendships were formed.
Can you remember the names of anybody apart from Overton who was in 4 Company?
No, I can't. Charlton, the fellow I told you about, he was in 4 Company.
This was the chap who was killed from Leeds, who was killed at Parama.
And there are others whose faces I can remember quite clearly, but names, as I said, I didn't know many names at that time. I don't know. I can't remember the names now.
How long were you at Madrigueras?
Well, I think we went to Madrigueras at the end of December. I'm not sure. It was either the end of December 36 or early January 1937. I can't remember which. And we left about February the 8th, something like that. February the 7th, February the 8th. By train. And we went by train to a little town called Chinchon. Well, it was a village, a big village, really. And from Chinchon, we could hear the artillery fire and we could see the anti-aircraft fire in the sky. You know, the anti-aircraft shells exploding. So we knew we weren't that far away from the battlefront. And we were there, either one or two nights, I can't remember which. And then in the middle of one night, we were moved off in trucks. We didn't go that far. I can't say how far we went because it was night time, it was dark, but it wasn't that far. And we got out of the trucks and we went into a yard where there was a big white building and it was filled with big wine casks. And we were given coffee and told to have a rest there. And I could see that in the dark, I could see that there was hills in front of us going up from behind this white building. And in the early morning, it was light, but it was still early morning. We were roused up and told that the enemy were coming, and off we went up the hillsides. And of course, that was the start of it. That was where we were going into action at the Battle of Parama. And that's on the other tape. Like, you know, I've dealt with that pretty thoroughly on the other tape. My impressions of it, anyway.
Is there anything that you want to add that isn't on the other tape?
About the Battle of Parama? Not really. Not really, I don't think.
When were you pulled out of the front at Parama?
Well, I was sent to hospital at the end of the first day because I was wounded. So I was away about 10 or 12 days and I was back again with the battalion, and we were there until May. By the time I got back after coming out of hospital, it was down, you know, both sides had dug in trenches, and it was just a case of sitting it out then in the trenches, like, you know, occasionally there'd be a little bit of a do, but more often than not it was quiet enough. And we were there until May, and then we were taken out. And we were taken to some village, the village we went to was, I think it was called Ambeaty, Mondeca.
What happened there?
Well, we were just having a rest there, more or less, that's all. It was just a case of, you know, just 9/10 of the day you were just lounging about. It was up to you what you did. There was very little activity at all.
How much contact were you having with the Spanish villagers?
Not a lot. It was up to the individual. If you spoke Spanish, you could get on. Some of them were even invited into the homes and had meals with them. But you had to speak Spanish to do that, and I didn't speak a lot of Spanish. I never got invited into any home. But I did go into the cafes in the village, you know, and I'd have a glass of wine or something like that, and talk with the locals in the as far as I could with the locals in these cafes. But that was all there was to it.
What impressions did you get of the kind of life they were leading?
Well, they weren't leading a very good life, because naturally all the younger people were off fighting, as you might say, and nearly all the villagers who were left were the wives and the elderly people. That's all. So I don't think life was very good for them, because there wasn't a lot of food, you know. There was very little food. And they had even less than us. We didn't. Well, we never starved, but we didn't. We never ate luxuriously. And the civilians did very, very poorly, because they had very short rations.
So you didn't make any specific Spanish friends?
No, no.
Did you see any signs of political activity amongst the civilians?
Not really. Not amongst the ordinary civilians, you wouldn't see any. But it was there, because these little bars they had where they held the little evening sessions, as you might say. Every single one you went to, they all had the Union flags up and the posters are urging everybody to do what they could. So there was activity somewhere. It was behind the scenes. I never saw it, but it was coming from somewhere.
What particular parties did the civilians seem to support?
Well, I can't really say that, because I didn't know the civilians well enough, but there were so many factions at that time. They were nearly all connected with the union. There were a lot of unions, and every union had its own flag and motto and everything. And in a certain area, you'd get a certain union pushing forward. In another area, it'd be a different union. They'd be putting forward, pushing forward. But they were all pushing forward with the same aim, and that was to win the war. I mean, Catalonia, for instance, the anarchists were union was a, well, it was a political party rather than a union. It was a union, but it was a political party as well. And they seemed to be in the dominance there for a long, long time.
Did you see any signs of political conflict?
Not really, because we weren't. We never got near the political side of it, as you might say, on the civilian side, you know. And whether there was any political conflict or not, I don't. There was. I do know there was in Catalonia, because there was a good big battle in Barcelona at one time when they ousted the anarchists.
This, I think, was in May 1937.
Well, I don't really know when it was, but I mean, I wasn't there. I only know because I've heard about it, you know.
How did the men in the International Brigade react when they heard about the troubles in Barcelona?
Well, I don't think they took a lot of notice of it, really. They were involved in their own battles with the enemy. Mind you, in 1937, you see, we were in the Madrid area, you know, South Madrid, North Madrid, and our battles were there. But towards the end of 1937, the battalion was moved over to the Aragon, which had been run by the anarchists up till during 1937, and there'd always been friction because the anarchists wouldn't attack. They were just stationary in the Aragon, and it was even said that the officers from each side used to visit each other's sides at night and to play tennis with each other. That was a common tale at the time. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it is significant that the front never moved in the Aragon. There was no fight in there. And the anarchists, as I say, they were in complete control at that time, but they were ousted. And towards the late summer, the international brigades were moved over to that side to make an offensive. And they did make an offensive at Belchite.
Did you get much impression of life in Madrid?
Well, I was in Madrid a couple of times, really. Once when I was in hospital and once when I was allowed a few days leave there. It was too close to the front line, you know. I mean, when I was taken to hospital from Parma there, the hospital I went to, well, there was two or three of us, British fellas, we went to this hospital, and I shall always remember it. There was two identical houses, like big mansions, you'd call them, with one driveway, and they were really one house, but in two parts, and they were identical. And there were massive rooms inside, and they'd been turned into a hospital. And it was on a long, straight road, right in Madrid, right... Well, you can tell how close it was, and just saying, the first night, I was asleep, I was in bed, in this hospital. And all at once, these guns let out, rifles and machine guns, and I could have sworn they were in the street outside. They were that close, you know. They just sounded like a battle taking place out in the street, just outside. So the following day, I asked. And you can believe it or not, we were only 200 yards from the front line, this hospital was, in Madrid. It was only just down a little slope in the road and up the other side. And the top of there was the front line, University City. That's how close it was.
What was the name of the hospital?
I can't really tell you. It'll be in that blue book. I know it was on Calle de Leon. Chambery was the district.
Now, what's happened to you after your periods in Madrid? Did you take part in the Battle of Brunete?
Oh yes, oh, I was in that, right. Well, most of it anyway. I was hospitalised again from there.
Can you tell me what you saw of the battle?
Well, it was a funny old thing really, because we started off from the top of some hills, and we could see our objective for that day was a village lying on the plain down below. That was the objective of the British battalion, and there was one or two other battalions involved as well, right? But they were, you know, they were on our flanks, so we didn't bother about them. The brigade would look after all that. And we went down the slopes of this hillside, down into the onto the plain, and I remember seeing cavalry cavorting along round the outside of the village. Our cavalry, they were going backwards and forward, perhaps half a mile away from the village. There was a wall around the village. This cavalry were going round there while we were going down this hillside, and then we wormed our way to a position 200-300 yards away from the village wall, and we were stuck there, and it was a baking hot day, and I went to try to get some water. I thought there'll be some because normally nearly all the villagers have, you know, what they're not pumps, they're perpetually running fountain things, you know, running into wells. And I felt sure there was one outside the village, and I thought I'd go have a look. So I wormed my way to a ditch at the side of a road that ran straight to the village, almost straight. There was a slight bend in it near the village. I worked my way down that there to this bend, and as soon as I went round this bend, I came under fire from the village. And I got trapped there. I couldn't go back and I couldn't get forward. But I was in that dike all afternoon till dusk. And when it wasn't really dark, it was three quarters dark, as you might say. And all at once, there was such a hell of a blue, such shouting and shooting and screaming, quite close to me. It wasn't ever so far away, not more than 30 or 40 yards, and I couldn't see, I couldn't tell what it was all about. And the only thing I can really remember is Fred Courtman's voice shouting, "Stop firing, stop firing." And everything went deathly quiet. And no one had come past on the road, one way or the other. And no one came past on the road, one way or the other. And I was still in this dike, looking around. I couldn't see anybody. And, it was perhaps 5 or 10 minutes later. I was still in the dike, and three blokes appeared, silhouetted above me, with the bayonets sticking at me. I had to get out of the dike, of course, and they wanted to know who I was, Pelham British Battalion, who's the commander. Well, I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know what had gone on. I didn't know whether the enemy or who the hell they were. They weren't British, I knew that. So, when they asked me who the battalion commander was, I told them Jock Cunningham. So, they took the bayonets into me and marched me off down to the village. I thought, oh, I've said the wrong thing here.